Connected live. Catch the broadcast on kaya959.co.za. X-Files.
One point of view.
That's what we do every single Tuesday. We look into those files and try and get ourselves acquainted with some of the most horrific crimes committed during apartheid, a little bit of our history, and also hoping for some closure with some of the families. Ahmed Timol, you may remember this case for a very, very long time. The family looking for justice, asking for government to reopen the case, because it was in 1971 when the police had arrested him, and 4 days later was declared dead. And they had said he had jumped out of the 10th floor window at John Foster Square. If you remember anything about John Foster Square, you'd know that a lot of those kinds of stories came out of that. On the line with us is Ahmed's younger brother, Mohammed Timol, just to help us understand this case a bit better. I really appreciate you giving us your time, Mohammed. Good evening and welcome.
Good evening to you and welcome to your listeners. Can you hear me?
I really can hear you. It is loud and clear. Just maybe start by you know, give us your own description of your brother, how you remember him, how as the family you remember him. Do you know, what kind of a person was he?
My brother Ahmed, I was 7.5 years younger than Ahmed.
Yes.
He was a very compassionate young man. Mm-hmm. He was the eldest son of the family. Mm-hmm. We were two brothers and four brothers and two sisters. Mm. Ahmed was his eldest son and his second sibling. Mm. He was very close to my parents. Mm-hmm. From an early age, he was very conscious of the apartheid system that we were growing up in. We lived in Roodepoort, which is about 20 kilometers west of Johannesburg, mm-hmm. A small Indian community. Mm. The African people in Roodepoort townships were moved to Dobsonville. Mm. But we had daily interaction with the African people in Roodepoort. Mm. So Ahmed grew up in Roodepoort. He went to school at the Johannesburg Indian Teachers Training College, mm. because there was no high school in Roodepoort when he was growing up. And he finished his matriculum in Johannesburg. Mm. The Johannesburg Indian High School was in Fordsburg, very near the Bloemfontein Station. And after he finished work, due to the dire financial situation of the family, my father was partially blind. Mm. Ahmed had to go out and work at the age of 18. Mm. He worked for 1 year as a bookkeeper, at a bookkeeper's office, and then he got a bursary to go into teaching. Mm. He was at the Johannesburg Indian Teachers Training College for 3 years, mm. and he successfully completed his teaching program. And he started teaching at the Roodepoort Indian High School in 1964.
Yeah.
He was an excellent cricketer.
Oh, really?
He was an excellent cricketer.
Something must have conscientized him. I mean, you say obviously you live very closely to African communities, and obviously you saw what happened during those days. But he could have gone on and done his own thing, as you said. You know, he went to a teaching college. He loved cricket. Was it because there were talks in the family? Who inspired him? Who made him aware of the fact that, yes, life may be slightly better for this home? Yes, and I know you've just spoken about the economic conditions, but, you know, there are people who are going through a much worse struggle.
Sister, my sister.
Yeah.
Growing up at that time, if you were not affected, then you don't have a heart, you do not support humanity. Mm. We were all affected. Mm. And some were more affected than others. Mm. I think Ahmed, the circle of friends he was with, they were all politically conscious. And you must remember the 50s. In the 50s, with the African National Congress and the huge support that he had, with the Transvaal Indian Congress, with the Colored People's Congress, with the Congress of Democrats, right? The Congress movement was very much alive. We all heard of Mandela. We all heard of Sisulu. And in fact, my father was a very close friend of the great leader called Dr. Yusuf Dadu, who was from Krugersdorp, but he had a practice in Johannesburg in N Street. So within the Indian community, there were people who were very conscious and very active in mobilizing the Indian community against the unjust apartheid laws. And the Transvaal Indian Congress, the political organization of the Indian people, had an alliance with the African National Congress. So this was all consciousness. We're becoming conscious. I, from a very early age, I also started becoming conscious. The fact that you live in a small town, you're discriminated against, you call all sorts of names, you call coolie, you refer to as coolie. Right. Also, you cannot take a train. If you're taking a train to Johannesburg, you've got to sit in a different compartment. Right. There is, out of the 8 coaches, 5 coaches were for whites and 3 coaches were for blacks. And when I say blacks, I mean Africans, Indians, and coloreds.
Mm.
Right. There were schools in Rudiput. You could not attend to the schools in Rudiput, right, because it was only for whites only. We didn't have a tennis court or a swimming pool, in a public tennis court or swimming pool. So all these things, you know, it has an impression on one that there's something very wrong and you've got to do something about it. But as growing up, his closest friend were Isup and Aziz Pahad.
Yes.
And another school teacher who lived in Rudiput, who was a close friend of my brother Ahmed, was Yusuf Jojo Saluji. Right. Isup and Aziz Pahad were already members of the Indian Congress. Their whole family was very involved. The father was a member of the Transvaal Indian Congress. The mother was an activist who had been in prison many times. In fact, Mandela called Mrs. Pahad as a very strong woman who was actively involved in politics in the struggle against apartheid. So all the, it was the people you associated with and the conditions that you live in and the discrimination against the fellow human being you became conscious about. Moving forward, Ahmed was a school teacher. He had the most excellent relationship with his students. In fact, he was also my teacher in 1964.
Oh,
he was my teacher in 1964.
Did you get special treatment, Mohammed?
Not at all.
Yes.
He had a way with the young people. In a way, he was conscientizing the young people that this apartheid of ours, you've got to find a way, you've got to overcome it. Not indirectly, but indirectly. Right? He was very loved by students, or the learners, students, or we call them learners now. He was a popular school teacher in Rudiput, which was 10 minutes walk away from our school, from where we lived in a small flat. In 1966, and after his two closest friends had went into exile, Isup and Aziz Pahad. The reason why they went into exile, because they were banned. In 1964, they were banned. And because they were banned, they couldn't communicate with one another. Imagine two brothers living and sleeping in the same room in a small flat, were not allowed to talk to one another. So they decided the best thing is for them to leave South Africa. And at that time, the apartheid regime gave you an exit permit.
Yes.
That means never to return again.
Yes.
But you left your country, your mother country, you went abroad, but continued the struggle against apartheid. Right? So Ahmed's other close friend who lived in Jodhpur and also a school teacher got married and left for Zambia. And Ahmed decided at the age of 26, he informed the family and informed my parents he wanted to go for pilgrimage to Mecca. On December 26, 1966, he left via Kenya for Mecca, Saudi Arabia.
Yes.
To perform the Muslim ritual of Hajj.
Yes.
And while he was there, he met my mother's brother, who was living in India.
Yes.
My mother's brother, my uncle and his wife and his son also came to Mecca to perform the pilgrimage. And Ahmed shared a tent with them in the place called Mina. That's where the Hajj is performed, the pilgrimage. And it so happened around that same time, the 1967 Hajj, Dr. Yusuf Dadu, who went into exile in 1960, and Moldy Kachalia, both leaders of the Transvaal Indian Congress. Moldy Kachalia was based in India. He left for exile in India. Dr. Dadu was in London. They came for pilgrimage to Mecca. And the purpose of the pilgrimage was to make contact with South African Muslims who are coming for pilgrimage. And my brother Ahmed was Dr. Dadu's patient. He had a chest problem and he was a regular patient visited to Dr. Dadu's surgery in Ansley, Johannesburg for treatment. In Mecca, I think my brother Ahmed was convinced, or whatever discussion they had, after the pilgrimage, Ahmed went to Cairo. And from Cairo, when he was in Cairo, the Middle East war broke out in 1967 between the Arabs and the Israelis. He subsequently left for London. And Issoub Pahad, the late Issoub Pahad, Minister Issoub Pahad, recalls that one morning there was a knock on the flat door, and when they opened, it was Ahmed Timo who had come to London. And he stayed with them. And within a few days, he got himself a teacher's job at the school that taught immigrant children from the subcontinent.
Okay.
He taught at the school from 1967, 68, and in 69, he secretly left London with Thabo Mbeki, former President Thabo Mbeki, and another member of the ANC, Communist Party, called Ann Nicholson. They were sent to the Soviet Union, Russia, to Moscow, to study at the Lumumba Institute. Now, Ahmed left the country legally. And going to Moscow, it was found out you were in trouble. You would get arrested.
Yes.
So Ahmed went there for training. And former President Thabo Mbeki, in my nephew's book called A Quest for Justice, he wrote a foreword to that book. And it talks about the 9 months they shared in the same room. They lived in the same room for 9 months. They shared the same weather in Moscow, the cold, the friendship. And Ahmed then returned to London. And after returning to London, he returned to London around November 1969. In 1970, he returned to South Africa.
Do you know, so obviously the plan, immediately when he went to Russia, the plan was to go and train him, to come back and you know, join the struggle, the military struggle.
The underground struggle. Let's not talk about military at the moment. Mm. We were living in a time when the resistance to the apartheid regime was all smashed.
Yes.
The Rivonia trial took place. Mandela and the leaders of the African National Congress were all in prison or in exile. The South African Communist Party members were in exile or in prison. Dr. Dadu, the leader of the Indian Congress, was in exile. There was no real political activity. Yes, Winnie Mandela, and they were arrested in 1969. And there was a trial, but they were all acquitted then. So there was a beginning of reviving the Congress movement. But Ahmed's job, the task and the mission he was given, live a normal life. And you've got to do underground work, and mainly, I would say, assess the political situation in South Africa, communicate that to us, and recruit people, without recruit the best you can find. Not into your unit, but give us the names that we can contact them directly in order to work for the underground. So Ahmed was one of the first people who had returned to work in the underground. But he came under the auspices of the South African Communist Party and the ANC. Mm. He came from London. And during that 20 months before his arrest, he kept secret communication, no cell phones, no telephones, secret communication by post with his contact in London. And he was getting instructions from London. He kept London, his Communist Party and the ANC informed of the political situation in South Africa, not from the media, of someone who was trained to assess the political situation. And unfortunately, he and his friend, who was a second-year medical student, were arrested at a roadblock on the 22nd of October, 1971. It was a Friday evening near the Coronation Hospital, which is now called the Rahima Musa Hospital. They were taken to the Newlands Police Station, and then taken to John Foster Square. At John Foster Square, they were separated. And then the interrogation began.
Mohammed, just before you continue, was there a sense that the roadblock was actually put up for their arrest? In other words, the police knew that they were going to apprehend him, or that at least that was the intention of the roadblock?
Yes. Now, very briefly, I also, in 1968, Ahmed had called me over. I finished my matric. I went to study in the UK. On my return from the UK in 1971, at the end of September, I had a meeting with Dr. Dadu. I was also trained in underground work. I volunteered as well to be involved in the underground work in South Africa, without my brother Ahmed knowing about it.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Dadu told me, please, when you get home, if Ahmed is okay, he's not arrested, please send me a secret communication on a postcard, which I did.
Mm.
Ahmed fetched me from the airport, right? And my plane arrived at about 10 o'clock at night from Paris. We arrived at the flat, went to bed. My mother woke me up the next morning. Ahmed was teaching. And my mother told me, I came back home after 3 years. And she told me, your hair is too long. You look like a hippie. Let it go for a haircut.
Yes.
And you know, Pumelo,
yes.
The night before,
yes.
Aziz Pahad's wife, Aziz Pahad told me, going home, your hair is too long, you better have a haircut. And his wife gave me a haircut.
Yes.
But the haircut was not short enough for my mother. So I went to the local barber,
yes,
which I went to when I was a teenager.
Yes.
Coming back to South Africa 2 years, in 1966, I was arrested at the Lilliput School for anti-apartheid activities,
mm-hmm,
with 600 people. And we were charged and we were arrested. We were interrogated and received a suspended sentence.
Okay.
So when I went to the barbershop and I returned, I'm hardly 12 hours in the country.
Mm.
My mother tells me the security branch came looking for you.
Sure.
And the same guy, when you were studying in the UK, came from time to time asking for you.
Hmm. So are we to assume that clearly there was an askari there? There was someone who told the security branch.
Someone. So I went to the police. I went to the offices in Bulipur.
Hmm.
And when this chap sees me, he said, "No, we don't want you. We want Ahmed." When did you arrive from London? So the thing is that I think Ahmed was being monitored,
yeah,
and I was being monitored.
Yes.
Right. So all indications are he was arrested at the roadblock which was set up.
Mm.
And that same evening, there were raids throughout South Africa of activists, known activists, not involved in the underground, but known activists,
mm,
people who are against the party.
Mm.
They were all raided. Journalists, students, professional people, all of us, a lot of people were raided. I was in Durban and I was not aware that Ahmed was arrested.
Mm.
I only got to know of it on Monday morning when I was detained in Durban.
Mm.
And my interrogation started,
mm,
in Durban.
Mm.
Right. I was completely oblivious of Ahmed's arrest in Johannesburg on Friday night, the 22nd. I'm arrested on the 25th.
Hmm.
I'm told Ahmed is arrested. Do I believe the security police? I refuse to believe them. Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, I'm interrogated. I'm detained in the Section 6 of the Terrorism Act. I noticed around 4 at 6 in the evening, Wednesday evening, there's a change of atmosphere.
Yes.
And I was taken to a police station to sleep. But that happened every night, Monday night, late night, Tuesday night, but Wednesday night was strange. Thursday morning, they came and get me from the police station and they told me, if you don't cooperate with us, you are going to rot in the cell.
Mm.
They threw a writing pad and a pen and said, you're going to tell us all the truth, but nothing but the truth.
Mm.
I was so relieved when they left. But that evening, they came and informed me, we got bad news for your brother died.
Mm.
They didn't tell me the circumstances. I asked them how. They said, we don't know. But they had died on a Wednesday. I was on Thursday evening.
Sure.
The next morning, they drove me down back to the security police headquarters in Durban, and there was a newspaper poster. Foster speaks, death plunge. Death plunge, and the head of South, the Prime Minister Foster, he speaks about the death plunge. And then became a bit conscious it must be true,
mm,
whether Ahmed died or not. When we entered the police station, an Indian security policeman took me in the lift to the top floor, to one of the floors, and he extended his condolences. I couldn't believe it. But only on my release, 141 days later, when I was released unconditionally, I was taken home, I then came to find out what actually happened to Ahmed.
And the story that they told you at the time was that he had jumped.
They didn't tell me anything.
No.
They told my mother, they told my family,
mm,
that he jumped from the 10th floor,
mm,
of John Foster Square.
Mm.
And that there was an inquest in 1972. I was released by that time. I attended every day the inquest. Okay? And the security police gave their version of what happened. Right? And Rodriguez, who gave testimony in the second inquest, right, also gave his testimony. They were all laughing and smiling. They had a smart face. As far as they were concerned, they never lifted a finger on Timur, detaining. He was humanely treated. But 2 days before, a day before Ahmed's death in detention, Salim Esop, who was detained with Ahmed, was rushed to hospital, to General Hospital in Johannesburg, not the new one, the old one, near the Hillbrow Police
yes,
Station.
Yes, I see exactly where that is.
He was in a coma. He was in a coma. He was in a coma.
So clearly the story that they didn't touch him couldn't have been true, because you could see, you know, what his colleagues, what his friend looked like.
Exactly, exactly. So the thing is, my mother was informed on a Wednesday evening at 6 o'clock by a plainclothes, by a uniformed policeman, not the security police, but uniformed policeman, Ahmed is dead. Obviously, it was tragedy, shock, everyone. However, it was traumatic for the family, and I was not at home. I was in detention, so I knew nothing what was happening to my family. Nothing, nothing, nothing. When I got released, I then got to know what had actually happened to Ahmed. Fast forward, in 72, there was an inquest, and the inquest findings was that Ahmed was a communist, a trained terrorist, and he did not want to divulge his comrades, the names of his comrades. He took his own life. He jumped from the 10th floor of John Foster Square. We did not assault him. The bruises on his body, according to the magistrate, he must have had it before he was detained in the brawl. In 2017, due to and post-94 with democracy, my nephew, who was 5 years old when Ahmed was killed or died in detention, at the age of 12, I went into exile. I was detained again in 76 at the Soweto uprising. I was under house arrest again, and I then left for Mozambique. I had military training. I worked full-time for the ANC. My nephew, my escape from South Africa had a tremendous impact on him. And he, on his holidays to my mother's place, he should ask my mother, what happened to Uncle Ahmed? And why did Uncle Mohammed leave? So my mother gave him those volumes and volumes of newspaper cuttings which I had put in a scrapbook, which my family kept for me when I got released from detention. So my nephew went through everything. And with the unbanning of the ANC, he then started, then the TRC, my mother was at the TRC, and Imtiaz Kaji pursued the story of his uncle. Right. And with his relentless efforts and with the support of the Foundation of Human Rights, Jasmine Suka, who was a TRC commissioner,
yes,
and felt strongly about unfinished business of the TRC, the Foundation for Human Rights, my nephew Imtiaz Kaji, convinced the MPA that there's sufficient evidence to reopen the inquest. The judge, Billy Motley, had defied, and he agreed to reopen the inquest in June 2017, 45 years later. 45. And what defining of that inquest was his history, that Ahmed Timur was brutally tortured. He was hit with a pipe on his forehead. He was unconscious. And they either threw him from the 10th floor of the building or from the roof of the building. Timur did not commit suicide. He was murdered in detention. And in that inquest, Salim Esop, who was detained with Ahmed, and he served a 5-year sentence, He was on Robben Island with Nelson Mandela, Walter Sisulu, Ahmed Kathrada in the same section. He was a medical student, 22 years old. He was sentenced to 5 years. And Mrs. Amina Desai, who was our auntie, was also sentenced to 5 years because Ahmed had used her house for his underground work. She was a widow and she was a relative, and Ahmed used to drive around and use her car, and he was arrested in her car. So Selim Esso came to South Africa to relive what had happened to him in detention, interrogation, 45 years before. It was traumatic for him to go through that again. He had never spoken about his detention and about his torture to anyone publicly. For the first time, and thanks to our defense team, which was Howard Vani pro bono, that was hired by the Foundation for Human Rights, we had two pathologists, right, who examined the records and the photographs taken at the mortuary. And with modern science, they discovered that his ankle had a fracture in his ankle, that he had a fracture in his forehead, that could have only happened with an iron bar or kicked with a shoe with an iron tip, right? And then that was brutally tortured. And an aeronautical engineer, testimony in an inquest.
Yes.
Aeronautical engineer, he got data on the 27th of October 1971. What was the weather like? What was the height of Ahmed? What was his weight?
Yes.
And what, if he had jumped from the 10th floor, how far would he land?
Yes. And obviously, what kind of injuries would he have had?
Exactly. Yeah. And according to the security police, he landed about 3 meters, between 1 and 3 meters from the edge of John Foster Square. According to the aeronautical engineer, if you jump from that height, you land about 10 meters away, and not 3 meters away, not 2 meters away, 10 meters away.
Let me ask you this, Mr. Timo. Do you...
Mohammed.
Mohammed, it's fine. Okay, I'll ask you, I'll call you by your first name. You know, has there been closure? How important was getting to the bottom of the truth was for the family?
Pamelo, the post-94, the records of the Department of Justice showed those people, that 72 to 75 political detainees who died in detention, they either committed suicide, they either fell on a bough of slope, or they hanged themselves, or they died of injuries falling from steps. There was never an inquest said that they were killed, they were murdered, they were tortured. So what was important? The reopening of the inquest, that Ahmed Timor did not commit suicide. And that is not history, and that is a facts. That is a fact which is in the legal documents of Democratic South Africa. Very important that we need closure for the 70-odd families who lost their loved ones as political detainees who were tortured and brutalized and who died at the hands of the notorious Gestapo security police. So far, to date, there's only a few inquests that have been finalized. The Imam Harun inquest, who was killed in 1969, that he did not die falling from stairs. He was assaulted, brutal, and he was killed. Dr. Neil Agut did not hang himself. He was tortured and he was killed. Dr. Hussein Haffagee in Pietermaritzburg, within 24 hours, he was brutally tortured and killed. There are other inquests that are open and needs to be finalized. We should support all those people. We should support the Foundation for Human Rights, who is in the forefront looking at the unfinished business of the TRC. Not only deaths in detention, but those that disappeared, those actors that were tortured and killed by the security police, not in detention, outside detention. In closing, Pamela,
yes,
I think for our younger generation, they must know there's this democracy, this freedom that we are enjoying in South Africa today was not given on a platter for us. It was a hard-fought struggle against a brutal, oppressive, racist regime. They did not give us democracy. We fought for it. Not only the African National Congress, the people, the oppressed people of South Africa who were fed up, it had to come to an end. Those mothers who saw their young children left after the Soweto uprising and went to exile for military training or for education, we owe it due to them. In when I did military training in Angola under the auspices of the ANC, I met a lot of young people that I was in training with, and we lifelong comrades and friends, but we also lost a lot of people,
yes,
who came into the country, who either died or askaris gave them away.
Yeah.
So this freedom was a hard-fought freedom that the majority of oppressed people and those few whites who supported our struggle, that's why we overcame the apartheid regime, and we're very fortunate we had a peaceful transfer from apartheid to democratic South Africa.
I really, really appreciate you giving us your time to take us through this memory lane. Ahmad Timol's younger brother, Mohammed Timol, I really appreciate your time. Thank you.
I attended Nelson Mandela's inauguration in 1994 May at the Union Buildings.
All right, we may have also just lost that audio. All right, that was Mohammed Timol, Ahmed Timol's younger brother. And really, thank you so much for the family, for giving us permission to go back into history looking at this particular story. And thank you very much, Mohammed, for your time.
If you missed it live, catch the broadcast on kaya959.co.za.